Hello, and welcome to Rabble Radio. It's Friday, June 24th, 2022. I'm your host, Breanne Doyle. Thanks so much for tuning in. Rabble's got its finger on the beat of the issues that matter to you. If you're curious about the latest news in Canadian politics, labor, environment, or social justice, you've come to the right place to find the stories that matter to you. Free of corporate influence. This week on the site, Rabble's national politics reporter Stephen Wenzel reviewed Martha Painter's new book, Abortion to Abolition, Reproductive Health and Justice in Canada. This week on the show, we're sharing an interview between the two where Painter dives into the misconceptions people have about access to abortion in Canada and the other threats facing reproductive justice in the country. Painter explains that Canadians generally view our country as the most progressive in the world with respect to abortion care. The truth is, though, that abortion access is poorly understood in our country, and so are the continual threats to reproductive justice in Canada, such as sexual violence, gun violence, homophobia and transphobia, criminalization of sex work, reproductive oppression of Indigenous women and girls, privatization of fertility health services, and the racism and colonialism of policing and the prison system. Abortion to Abolition, Reproductive Health and Justice in Canada tells the empowering true stories behind the struggles for reproductive justice in Canada, celebrating past wins and revealing how prison abolitionism is key to the path forward. Martha Painter is a registered nurse providing abortion and postpartum care in Halifax, Nova Scotia. Painter is the founder and chair of Wellness Within, an organization for health and justice. Painter is also a frequent contributor to the CBC, The Coast, The Conversation, The Halifax Examiner, and Saltwire, where she writes about publicly funded healthcare, prison abolition, and gender equity. Abortion to Abolition is her first book. Here are Painter and Wenzel in conversation. Take a listen.
So, Martha Painter, this is your first book, is that correct?
Yes, it is.
Yes, so I'm wondering if we can start off, what's the response been like so far? The book's been out a few weeks now.
Really positive. I think it is filling a gap in people's understanding of abortion and other reproductive justice issues in Canada. And it also was opportunely timed with the increasing threats to reproductive rights south of the border. And you know, one of the reasons I wrote the book was to make sure people north of the border knew, despite the infiltration and overwhelming presence of U.S. news in our lives, that it is different here. And so that message needed to come out loud and strong again in May, and that's when the book came out.
Well, it was good timing for that. And, you know, I think there's so many misconceptions about reproductive rights and reproductive justice in Canada because we're so inundated with what's going on with Roe v. Wade, which is a completely separate kind of operating system. But so I'd like to start talking about abortion and then expand the conversation because, as you wrote in the book, abortion is only one aspect of reproductive justice. And while we certainly center a lot of the discussion around abortion, one thing that I thought was important in your book was you talked about choice and what choice actually looks like. So if there's someone on Cape Breton Island that has to drive to Halifax to have abortion care, do they really have a choice? Can you talk a little bit about the need to ensure that everyone has all of their options to choose from feasibly in order for abortion access to really be equitable?
So there's always going to be limitations in terms of health service provision in Canada. Some of the limitations are absurd. For instance, we really should be able to provide aspiration surgical abortion services on Cape Breton Island. That said, at least we do have medication abortion services. So that's an example of it could definitely be better, and we will get there eventually. But on the flip side, you don't want to have brain surgery in a tiny little hamlet. So there are always going to be limitations. But what changes the accessibility when you're faced with those geographic restrictions is money. And we continue to see, just in Nova Scotia, where I'm based, as an example, absolutely no progress on child poverty, which is a moniker for women's poverty. We see increasing threats of housing insecurity, food insecurity. There are just these really basic needs that are not met. And that's where the choice doctrine is really nonsensical. And that was very clearly identified by the reproductive justice movement led by Black feminists in the United States, that really their lens is very focused on the impact of racism in limiting choice, while also acknowledging there are all these other layers of oppression that impact choice making.
I'm wondering too, I didn't realize until I read your book just how involved you were with Clinic 554 or 554 in New Brunswick. And I'm wondering if you could share a little bit about your work with them and the legacy that the Clinic 554 has created.
Well, so yeah, I guess I started out as an escort back in the day when it was owned and run by Morgenthaler himself. And played a part in Reproductive Justice New Brunswick, the organization that worked after Morgenthaler's death to raise the funds to be able to purchase the clinic. And then when those funds were given to Dr. Adrian Edgar, who purchased the clinic, who then renamed it Clinic 554. And Clinic 554 remains really our national symbol of the enduring limitations. New Brunswick has always had, since 1810, the most restrictive and conservative approach to abortion access. And this lingering restriction, and we have to be very accurate about what this restriction is. So this restriction is in the New Brunswick Medical Services Payment Act, and it says you cannot be funded as a physician, you will not get paid if you do the abortion in a freestanding clinic. So this is by no means a ban on outpatient abortions. It's not a ban on abortion in any type, in any kind of way. It's not criminalization. It is a limitation on public funding. Very clearly in violation of the Canada Health Act, very clearly illegal, and yet they continue to get away with it. They have been penalized. The New Brunswick government has been penalized for this by the feds, but obviously not enough to make them change their behaviors. But it's very important that people in New Brunswick understand that you can self-refer to three hospital-based abortion clinics for surgical services, and you can have medication abortion prescribed by any primary care provider anywhere in the province. So things have changed a lot, and the threat that New Brunswick refusing to pay for services in that space on Brunswick Street, the threat that posed the population has changed. It's very, very important that people in New Brunswick know how to get care.
There was a term that you used in your book that came from Loretta Ross. It was reprocide. It's genocide through reproductive oppression. And for me, that was the first time that I'd heard that term. And for folks who might not be familiar, could you talk a little bit about reprocide?
So the great Loretta Ross, who's one of the founders of the reproductive justice movement, and I've had the good fortune of meeting several times, theorizes about reprocide as that combination of genocide and reproductive control. And what she's referring to is how the reproduction and the family planning, the family decision making of whole populations is controlled by certain policy decisions. So that the most obvious example is how racist control, a racist actualization of child protection policy, so that, for instance, here in Canada, 52% of the children who are in the foster care system are Indigenous. So that is killing the family, which, just like the residential schools, is intending and succeeding at destroying culture. So that's what she's referring to. And there are different processes that this can happen through. Of course, forced sterilization of Indigenous women in Canada would be an obvious example, as well as the child protection system. And in relation to my work, gross hyper-incarceration of Indigenous women, now 50% of the federal prison system, is another example. If you take the mother out of the family, you have killed the family planning, and you have prevented that population from continuing on. And that is a deliberate choice of the Canadian government.
Now, we're not just talking about long-term incarceration. We've talked before, Martha, about how even being incarcerated for a week can completely unravel all of the fundamental elements of somebody's life. And can you talk a little bit about that separation between caregiver and child and the actual health effects that that has on individuals?
So the average length of stay in a provincial facility in Canada is about a week, which is enough time to certainly lose your job, lose your house, miss your rent payment, and lose your children to the custody of the state, the foster care system. And once you've lost them, you can try for a year, year and a half to get them back, depending on the jurisdiction. And you have everything stacked against you. How are you going to get those kids back now that you've lost that house? So you, in one arrest, in 1 week of custody, you can ruin many people's lives. And the intergenerational trauma that this causes, it's not just the physical welfare that the child can have compromised in abusive foster care situations, sexual abuse, physical abuse, emotional abuse, but the long-term threat to their very identity and core sense of belonging, sense of worth. And that's why we see the foster care system as a pipeline back into the prison system for the whole thing to renew itself again.
Now, in your book, Martha, you took 23 pretty unique stories, and you told these 23 stories in a way to kind of intersect all of the different areas of reproductive justice. And to jump in there, I guess, I'm wondering, how did you choose these stories in particular? And are there any that didn't make it into the book that you wish had?
Yeah. Oh, God, I could have kept writing forever, right? I think a lot of the stories are the ones that in my, I do a lot of workshops with people who are in prison and to teach about their rights and to learn more about what matters to them. And a lot of these cases were cases that I would talk with people inside the prison system about, because that really resonates. People who are inside prison are extremely savvy with how the justice system works and very interested in that lens. And we all respond well to stories that have a face. So that really dominated my decision making. I wanted to have them all themed in appropriate tribute to the major tenets of this movement developed by Black feminists, that the right to bodily autonomy, the right to not have children, to have children, to parent in safety. And then, of course, my real concentrated interest in parents in prison. So I organized the cases around those themes. I could have kept going, and who knows, maybe there'll be a sequel. But I wanted to make sure that at the bare minimum, I was capturing the key dimensions of how reproductive autonomy is experienced.
One story that you told in particular was of Santina Rao. And since we're both based in Nova Scotia, this was a story that really caught headlines when it happened. A young Black woman who is walking through Walmart with her children in the middle of shopping is assaulted and taken down by police officers for not paying for products that she hadn't had the opportunity yet to pay for. Can you talk a bit about how that case in particular ties into reproductive justice in a greater sense?
Yeah, that's an excellent case. And of course, Santina's a local hero. We worked with Santina to develop the absolutely stunning portrait of Santina that is in the book. That was her choice. And she's such an incredible person. And I think that that really shows how we have this notion of some of these public institutions are, their point is to protect us. The prison system is to protect us. The police is to protect us. And that case showed just how blatantly, and in that case, the police was to protect a grapefruit, right? And when we think about how women will have their children taken from them because those women have been beaten in front of those children by an abusive partner, CPS will come in and take your kids for that. Meanwhile, the police can beat your mother in front of you because she hasn't quite made it to the checkout yet with that grapefruit. So I think it really clarified for everybody except the racists that the police protect property and they violate the bodies of women, of people of color, Black people. And that is their purpose. That is how they function. That is what they do. And there's no point in having, in being able to plan your family and being able to make these decisions about the kids you're going to have if the police are then going to harm your children, harm you in front of your children. It's one and the same thing.
And what I thought was so powerful about your book and about telling Santina's story is that you really went into the effects and the consequences of such a traumatic experience taking place both for the mother and the child, and all of the different things that go into that. And I'm wondering if you could talk a bit about the harms that were done and that we see through other cases like this.
So that family talk about how they will need long-term therapy. They have physical injuries that will affect them for the rest of their lives. Santina had two kids with her when she was brutally assaulted by the police. So there's the impact for those three individuals on their long-term physical and emotional health. But also that signals to the community generally that you aren't safe to shop. That is not a safe activity for you if you are a person of color in the city of Halifax. And, you know, this was happening in the same time as a lot of debate about the Street Checks report and the Wortley report. And we know we have the evidence that the Halifax police stop Black people for absolutely no reason whatsoever six times more often than they do white people. We have a police force that is very straightforward racist. And so I think that these events were really important precursors to the ongoing discussion that we continue to have in the city about defunding, what that means. We recently had Dr. L. Jones and a team of researchers publish the Defining Defunding Report. And this is something that we continue to grapple with. That we have a city of people that battle the Halifax Council about the municipality's responsibilities in relation to controlling what the police do. And lately, we've had that intersect with how the police treat the unhoused. And all of this is all about safety and our safety as parents, birthing people, as kids, to grow up in a society that is a just society.
Now, one other topic I'd like to talk with you about before I let you go, Martha, is pregnancy in prison. And, you know, in Canada, fortunately, there is a lot of autonomy for people who are pregnant when they're on the outside. On the inside, it's the complete opposite. You tell stories of women who had their babies ripped out of their arms after being born in a cell. A woman who miscarried because she was crying and pleading for help and she wasn't taken seriously. Not only are rights taken away from people when they're put in prison, but also their ability to make decisions to protect themselves, to protect their child, to protect their health, all of those things are compromised. And I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about, after spending so much time working with folks in the prison setting, can you talk a little bit about pregnancy in prison and some of the issues that I brought up.
One of the most obvious things is that we have so little data. So we have very few pieces of evidence about how frequent pregnancy is in prisons. We have no way of knowing if people's rights to, for instance, choose not to be pregnant and go outside for an abortion, if those are respected. American data, U.S. data, shows that only 1% of federal prisoners who are pregnant, those pregnancies end in abortion, whereas the national average would be at least 16. So that's some coercion right there. We don't know what's happening in Canada because we don't count. That's a big trend in Canada. See no evil, hear no evil. And so that's the most obvious thing to comment on, that we are deliberately keeping ourselves in the dark about what's happening to these people. But what has been exposed, usually by intrepid journalists, is that pregnancy is extremely dangerous for people who are inside, dangerous to the point that cannot be justified. And there are provisions in the Bangkok rules, international law, that would allow for non-custodial responses to criminalization in pregnant people. And we need to take that seriously because we are letting kids be born in extremely vulnerable states. We do have enough data to show that you are more likely to be premature, because prematurity is a leading cause of pediatric death. You're more likely to be premature. You're more likely to be low birth weight, small for gestational age. These states that make you a vulnerable neonate, more likely to experience newborn death and have all kinds of health sequelae for you, your family, and the health system to deal with. We need to take those seriously and intervene in this really incompatible situation where we have pregnant people in prison.
All right. And Martha, I guess my final question for you, I have to say I learned so much from reading your book, but what has writing this book taught you?
As has been my experience for several years now, I can blab on all day long, but if I could just put my thoughts on paper, then they're more useful to other people. So I appreciate being able to do that. And I'm really very grateful to Fernwood for asking for this project in the first place, and to Fazila Jiwa for two rounds of very serious edits. I'm happy it's out there. I hope it gets read a lot. I hope it meets my goals to be approachable and interesting and helpful for people who want to not only live really confidently themselves, but support the people around them to do the same.
That was Stephen Wentzel in conversation with Martha Painter, author of Abortion to Abolition, Reproductive Health and Justice in Canada. To learn more about the book and Painter's work in reproductive justice, read Stephen Wentzel's story on the site this week. Now it's time for a segment we call In Case You Missed It. And for that, I'll hand it over to the editor of Rabble.ca, Nick Seabrook. Over to you, Nick.
Thanks, Brianne. This week, Rabble.ca continues its coverage of Indigenous History Month. Indigenous educator and author Linda Gray shared a piece on the site this week about the importance of true reconciliation in Canada. Gray writes, "Many Canadians fear that reconciliation requires them to atone for any horrible things their ancestors or governments did to Indigenous peoples, or that they have to give up something. Others, especially businesses and governments, tend only to do performative actions such as wearing an orange shirt on September 30th, but do little else. We cannot stall, posture, or give in to our own perceived fragility. Rather, reconciliation requires that we be open, courageous, and become comfortable being uncomfortable." She continued, "Many Indigenous peoples prefer to use the term reconciliation, as it requires ongoing action, not just apologies, acknowledgements, listening, or reflecting." Also this week, Rabble shared our first installment of our new summer series, The Boiling Point. The Boiling Point series will examine the ways increasingly high temperatures due to the climate crisis are affecting our summers in Canada on a social, institutional, and ecological level. Around this time last year, much of British Columbia was enveloped in a heat dome. temperatures peaked at nearly 50 degrees Celsius, and nearly 1,400 people were estimated to have died due to the oppressive heat. This year, shelters braced themselves in case of another record-breaking hot summer. Earlier this week, Vancouver City Council announced they would provide $100,000 to the Downtown Eastside Single Room Occupancy Collaborative Society to be used to provide first aid training for 100 tenant volunteers and to create emergency cooling rooms in privately owned single occupancy room units. Rabble also shared this week a story from freelance writer Sonia Ali on how students are asking the University of Toronto to take accountability for a lack of available mental health support services. Since 2017, more than 10 students have died by suicide while attending U of T. The University of Toronto is being called up by students for the months-long wait time to see a counselor. Jan Lim, upon noticing how her peers were frustrated with U of T's mental health services, began collecting stories from students. She's already collected 75 stories from students from November 2020 up to the first half of 2021. One of those stories was from student Nagrez Hassan. Hassan lives with ADHD and anxiety, and she says that the hoops that students need to go through to access services can be daunting and a deterrent to seeking help. Hassan said, "I wish I never accepted to go to U of T because there's a lot of barriers, especially for students like me that have an ongoing disability." For its part, the University of Toronto states that following recommendations made by a presidential and provostial task force on student mental health, the university has redesigned its physical and virtual health and wellness spaces and services. They say that this has reduced wait times and made services easier for students to access. Finally, Rabble Labor reporter Gabriela Kaluye-Kasuga covered a report showing that Indigenous youths are having a hard time entering the workforce. A survey of 370 Indigenous youths from across Canada found that nearly half face barriers in finding meaningful work. The report states that some of these barriers, like intergenerational trauma, span across generations and have a profound impact on Indigenous youths' entire lifetimes. Barriers like precarious living situations, mental health and physical health issues, and interrupted work and educational experiences were commonly referenced by respondents. The report goes on to state that employers need to be willing to consider reasons behind resume gaps, be they raising a family, mental health, school, or other reasons, and not immediately disqualify candidates with several months or years between their work experiences. You can catch all of those stories and much, much more on rabble.ca.
Thanks, Nick. And that's it for Rabble Radio this week. Thanks as always for tuning in. If you like the show, please consider subscribing to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please rate, review, share Rabble Radio with your friends. It takes 2 seconds to support independent media like Rabble. Follow us on social media across channels at RabbleCA. Thank you to all the journalists and writers who contributed to this week's content on rabble.ca, and thank you to Carl Nirenberg for supplying the music. And finally, thank you to you for tuning in to Rabble Radio. I'm Brianne Doyle, and I'll talk to you next week.